This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Coming up, WGCU's John Davis sits down to hash out what lawmakers will face in their next legislative session, particularly as a tight budget is stretched even thinner by hurricane recovery efforts. But first, the MacArthur Foundation just named its 2017 class of fellows, and one name in particular may stand out to Southwest Floridians, and that is Greg Asbed. Asbed is a human rights strategist who attended Brown University, where he met Laura Germino. After going on to get his master's at Johns Hopkins University, he did some work in Haiti before coming to Southwest Florida with Laura in 1993. It's here where the two started the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or the CIW. In the coalition's nearly 25-year history, the Southwest Florida group has gone from a hyper-local human rights group to a national and, in some cases, international one through the spread of its Fair Food program. Now, Asbed has earned himself a $625,000 so-called genius grant to continue his work in the community. He joins us now by phone. Greg, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to talk with you. We're talking with local human rights strategist Greg Asbed about his work with underrepresented populations in Southwest Florida. You can join the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Greg, before you became the co-founder of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, you spent 3 years working in Haiti. In a 2003 New Yorker article called Nobodies, the reporter paints the picture of life in Immokalee so vividly that someone across the country can almost picture the town. And you're quoted in that article, written 10 years after starting the coalition, and at that time, you were still stunned by what you were seeing in Immokalee. How did it compare to your experience in Haiti?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, they're two very different contexts. In Haiti, you know, the poverty is as deep and as difficult for survival as it can be. You know, Haiti's the poorest country in this hemisphere. And so the fight there is really just for, it's actually for survival, for physical survival, for the people who just don't have any means to support themselves. So it's a profound battle for the families that organize in Haiti to have a voice in the country and to have, you know, a chance to advance themselves and feed their families and get education and all that. So all those things are so fundamental there that it's kind of a different context from here. Here, though, this was definitely the deepest poverty and sort of grossest exploitation that I had ever seen in my own country. You know, the situation in Immokalee when we first got here was just, it seemed sort of like the Wild West of labor conditions. There was, you know, you could see people getting beaten on payday in the street, right there. And, you know, nobody would go to their defense. Nobody would stand up for them. They'd just be asking, you know, they felt they didn't get paid, but they should have gotten paid. And they'd face, you know, on not rare occasion, physical violence from their employers. You know, sexual harassment, sexual assault was extremely common. Even cases of modern-day slavery, which we ended up doing, you know, multiple investigations and prosecutions of those over the 90s and early 2000s with federal authorities. So those sorts of conditions in the 20th and 21st century in the United States are as shocking, in a sense, as the poverty and exploitation that you see in a place like Haiti, because you don't think that modern-day slavery should exist in the 21st century U.S., but it does, and it continues to exist outside the protections of the Fair Food Program that we've been able to put together.
So what brought you to Immokalee in the first place?
In the most sort of literal sense, there was a job that was open with Legal Services, Florida Rural Legal Services at the time, which is an organization that helps workers, in this case, migrant farm workers who have legal problems and don't have the money to get legal representation. And so there was a job here, and both my wife and I applied. There were two jobs open, and we got the job, and so we started working with the community through that.
And that's when you first started to see the things that you were mentioning that surprised you so much that actually existed here in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, our job, where we started here, and then also the coalition, is right here in the heart of the community in Immokalee. And if any of the listeners haven't been to Immokalee, you know, the visual scene that you see here in the heart of Immokalee has changed from over the past couple of decades, but not a whole lot. You know, there's still some very bad housing and just a sense that people are getting by, scraping by, you know. But fortunately, because of the program, we've been able to raise wages, we've been able to eliminate the violence. And so actually, a really interesting thing that came out in the paper the other day about a woman they were talking about the hurricane, and they were saying, you know, how is it living in a town that was already so poor and that was devastated by the hurricane? And she said, well, it's difficult. You know, our house was destroyed. But there's nowhere else I'd rather be, because living and working in Immokalee now, there's a respect that you don't find anywhere else in the fields in this country. So I don't want to leave this area. I want to stay here, even though our house was destroyed. And that's a good measure of how much it's changed and still how much has to stay, continue to change.
Yeah, and a pride of place. So how did this movement spread so widely? It's now gone national and in some cases international.
Well, you know, I think it's because it worked. In the end, what we have been able to put together is a very practical approach to protecting workers' fundamental human rights in corporate supply chains. And, you know, that has been a problem for decades that has been exposed ever since. When you think about the 90s, they were talking about conditions in Nike sweatshops overseas. And that was, I think, to a lot of people, that was the first exposure to the idea about the poverty and exploitation that takes place in corporate supply chains. And so that's been going on for a long time. The dominant paradigm for addressing that has been called corporate social responsibility, which unfortunately has failed, and failed spectacularly and miserably for the workers whose rights it's intended, or at least putatively intended, to protect. And so you have, you know, corporate social responsibility, which essentially has corporations that create supply, that create codes of conduct, and those codes are just simply some standards they say that must be met by their suppliers. And in terms of enforcement, there really is no enforcement in the traditional model. Instead, there can be occasional, like, annual audits for monitoring to see if the suppliers are meeting the code. But even those audits are easily gamed and are snapshots. Even the best audits done perfectly are still just going to be snapshots of a moment in a year when things can be, you know, infinitely worse during the rest of the time that the auditors are not there. So that system doesn't work. And the one that we've created does. And now it's had 6 years of you know, sort of proof in the laboratory in agriculture here in Florida, and it's created remarkable, unprecedented change.
So way back in 2008, I was actually at the Slow Food Nation event in San Francisco, where food writer Michael Pollan took the stage in a conference about fair treatment of farm workers. And I remember hearing the stories of the California labor organizations, many of which ended with a landowner who was punished for unfair practices, or some of them went out of business. And then the Coalition of Immokalee Workers representative spoke, and with the help of a translator. And it was a really different tactic to take, because instead of going after the owners of the land, they went after the people that insisted on paying really low prices for produce. Where did that idea come from?
Well, it came from this incredibly creative community, which, by the way, just let me just do this as a disclaimer. I know the award went to me, but the problem is awards sort of have an individual bias. And in fact, in this kind of work, in human rights work, there's no way that you can do anything by yourself. You know, everything is a collective effort. And so everything we've created, including the idea that you just asked about, how the idea of getting to the end buyer and harnessing the power of that end buyer to actually, instead of driving down prices and therefore driving down wages in the fields and driving conditions down, to harness that power to actually improve wages and improve working conditions. And that idea is something that came out of years and years of effort and, you know, and sometimes failure. You know, that's one thing that you learn in this process, is that you have to fail to succeed. You know, and so we attempted a whole array of other ways to try to change conditions here and did not succeed as much as we wanted to. And that's what drove us to reconsider our analysis of what makes farm workers poor. Why are farm workers facing some of the worst conditions in the country? And that's when we figured, you know, we realized that the powers that sort of determine conditions here in this town, for example, don't reside here. in this town. They are the huge buyers of produce that that are the retail food corporations.
It's just a model that I think it ended up getting results that worked. Instead of having a landowner or a farm owner going out of business because he's being told he has to pay more and he's not getting more money for the tomatoes that he's getting to large corporations, it seems like that you're going where the money's at, correct?
No, that's who's the guys at Why Do You Rob Banks? Because that's where the money's at. Not the same idea, but the same basic concept. Yeah,
yeah. It's not about robbing anybody. It's actually getting a fair payment for the product.
Exactly. It's going to where justice can be done, right? It's going to the place where you can actually find the resources and the power to make justice happen, where before you've been going to places where there just isn't the power to do that. You know, we have a harvesting cooperative that works in watermelons, and for years, you know, I've been part of that, and we've been talking to growers in watermelons up and down this country about, you know, about the work, about the pay. And they would often tell us, you know, I'd love to pay you guys more, but I only get 4.5 cents or 5 cents per pound from the buyer, and I can only give you 1.5 of that, or I'm just running, you know, at a loss. And it's the same thing writ large across agriculture. You know, the prices determine what kind of margin the farmers have to be able to pay fairer wages and provide better conditions. You know, if you can cut costs by not having a porta potty in the field and the workers go out, you know, go to the bathroom in the woods, then you do that. As bad as that is for workers, as bad as that is for food safety, that's the cost that you can cut, so you do that. But now, you know, that's not the case. And so we work now in great partnership, really close partnership with the industry, and things are changing that we didn't even expect to change, because once you start working in partnership, you realize that you have a lot of interest in common. You know, and so we found that with the growers that we work with, that the better the workers are treated, of course the workers are better off as a result, but the growers also have a more stable, more productive workforce. They become employers of choice. So if other industries need workers, workers don't as readily jump away from agriculture. They'll stay because they're enjoying the conditions they're finding. And the industry as a whole has a much better reputation in the market than it did before. And so now it can actually distinguish Florida tomatoes from, say, Mexican tomatoes, where none of these protections exist and where workers are facing some of the most horrendous conditions you can possibly imagine without any remedy. No recourse to try to change those conditions.
That was the next question I was going to ask you, is about the biggest competition that we're going to see as far as United States farm workers is, you know, produce coming in from other countries where the people are not offered the same types of protections, and they don't have as much of, well, they don't have a coalition of Immokalee workers there, right?
That's absolutely the case.
How are you going to be able to address that going forward, though?
Well, first of all, by exactly doing what I was just saying, which is to produce, to create a tomato, a product out of Florida that is not competing on cost. It's competing on other value that it represents to the consumer. So before the Fair Food Program, tomatoes were essentially widgets. You know, they were identical products. You could buy one from Mexico, you could buy one from Florida. But Mexico has a built-in cost advantage because they pay sub-poverty wages and they don't have to worry about conditions like we do here. But if you can actually create a product that distinguishes itself in the produce aisle as being a fair tomato, you know, one produced in a context of dignity and respect for the workers, that makes it something that can sell on that basis, not simply in competition of price. So that's one way. You know, the other is to constantly educate consumers about the conditions where they're the things that they buy and the things that they eat and the things that they give to their children to eat at home come from. And so one way to do that is to say, well, in this case here, the tomatoes are coming from a great, new, dignified context for workers. But another way to do that is also to say, but when you buy a tomato from Mexico, you have to know that violence against women in the fields of Mexico is off the charts. You know, it's absolutely horrendous, the level of violence against women in terms of sexual harassment and sexual assault against women in the field. And women there have no voice to be able to actually protect themselves, whereas here we have a program that has eliminated that kind of violence and given women a voice on the job. So education of consumers is hugely important, because consumers in the end have the power to tell the brands what they want to do. You know, that's, we will buy from you if you do X. That's how we got to where we are here, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Does it surprise you the way things have changed as far as the consumer's awareness of fair trade in the last 20-some years?
It's beautiful to see. It doesn't surprise me. It's beautiful to see because it's driving this, the success of this program and the continued success of this program into the future. It doesn't surprise me because we're in an age of the information age, you know, and, you know, when I was young and my mom or dad would take me to the grocery store, we had no idea what was behind the food we were buying, and nobody really had a way to know. There was no internet. There was no, you know, there was no availability of information to be able to get back behind the what you saw when you were buying the product. Today there is. Today, if people want to know, they can find out very easily. And that's only going to, that fluidity, that mobility of information from the supply chain to the consumer is only going to increase in the years ahead. So the companies that are smart are the ones that are getting on board with this ahead of time, getting out in front of this sort of thing ahead of time, and the others will follow suit.
So I wanted to ask you one more question before we go because we're running up against time, but you got this grant. It's more than $500,000 to continue your work. What do you see that doing for the organization?
Well, first of all, I'm donating it to the CIW, so it's not going to me. It's going to the organization. It's just going to help us. You know, the money will help us absolutely expand the work that we're doing. That's going to be important. And the visibility of this kind of award brings as well will help again educate consumers about this cause. So this comes at a great time. You know, we're expanding, the Fair Food Program is expanding into Vermont, in the dairy industry, in the beginning moments of expanding into Texas, and it continues to expand here into strawberries and into green peppers. So it comes at a perfect time to help fuel that expansion.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're gonna have to leave it there, but I wanna tell you I really appreciate your time, Greg Asbed. Congratulations once again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Coming up, a preview of the legislative session with WGCU's John Davis. And later in the show, we talk with the executive director of Clean Water for Haiti. We'll be right back. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU.